welcome to A City in Motion, where we will explore innovative approaches to transportation systems and discover strategies for making public transit more attractive for riders of all backgrounds. I'm your host, Jeremiah LaDuca, and throughout this podcast, I plan to give you diverse perspectives from engineers, architects, and urban planners. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome David Dixon, an expert in urban design and transportation strategy. David's work on walkable density, transit infrastructure, and redeveloping suburbia has transformed how we think about inclusive urban planning. Join us as we delve into the future of mobility and creating a vibrant, accessible cities for all. In addition, please make sure to like, comment, and subscribe. I'll be starting this over a very long period of time, and I'm excited to hear what people think. People that you guys want to have on, and I want to make sure I can get a full range of people. So please share your thoughts and ideas as I start putting this together. I already have the next one coming up next week, and that will be a surprise coming soon. Thank you guys. Thank you again for doing this. I guess the first question, I just wanted to go back on just some of your education and that experience and all the different organizations you are a part of. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I just wanted to hear a little bit about, I know you did social studies in the beginning and then did a master's in architecture and then went into urban planning later. And I wanted to hear about some of those experiences and how do you think that helped shape your, you know, what you're doing now, and if you would have changed anything, you know, back then, or wish you've, you know, dived in a little deeper into a specific area.
Frankly, at this point in life, I'm in the business of not wishing I had done things differently in the past, but trying to stay focused on what there is to do going forward. But I was in something called the College of Social Studies when I was an undergraduate, which I really loved. I could say I revered it. And what I revered about it was its strong focus on interdisciplinary, not multi, but interdisciplinary learning. So we were actually speaking a few minutes ago about the various perspectives that different disciplines bring to a topic like transit, whether it's about mobility, about economic development, about equity, et cetera, about the environment. This was a program that really taught us that within the realm of what was then called social studies, whether it's government or economics or history or sociology or any of the perspectives that come to bear, that understanding how they come together, what joint wisdom, what shared wisdom they can create was what really mattered. So I then, unlike everybody else in my program, we went to law school, basically decided I want to do one of two things, either get a degree, a PhD in history, because I always loved history, or in architecture, because I always loved architecture. I chose architecture. I don't mean to be self-serving. I actually turned out to be a pretty decent designer. I got an AIA gold medal or whatever for my design work.
That's amazing.
But what I realized I missed, and I missed it profoundly, was the understanding of why of the forces shaping the design I was doing, that which I may be in the cities I was doing them for.
Gotcha.
And this harkens, of course, immediately back to the College of Social Studies. You know, what was the nature? How was our evolving economy shaping the kinds of places I might have an opportunity to design, or the communities I designed for might have an opportunity to enjoy? What from a governmental standpoint, what were the politics shaping of these things? From a historical standpoint, what I would say history is in many ways about trajectory, you know, where were cities heading, et cetera. So I then got a degree in urban design and started working and became increasingly interested in, again, the broad term would be, from my perspective, planning, but the underlying forces shaping our world. And what did we need to do to manage those? Increasingly, planning and urban design, to me, in some ways, are about turning the forces of history, of grasping the forces of history, managing them, and channeling them to create the kinds of places that we want, need, and deserve. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's awesome. I guess some of those forces, can you go into a little bit of those? Like, I know there's so many, but any ones that stuck out to you?
Yeah, I can. For years, I knew I love cities. I knew at the same time that cities were suffering. I moved to Washington, D.C. to get a job because that was tough in those days. Then to Boston because I got a job that was much more interesting to me, doing sort of urban design and planning. Boston, this was because I'm very old, in the mid 1970s, later 1970s. Boston was then a very depressed city. Median household income was probably 70% U.S. median. Today is probably 125%, not more. It was a city that was recovering. No, it was not recovering. It had never really been an industrial city. It had been a port city, but it was part of America's industrial economy, which was in sharp decline, along with all the cities where that industrial economy had headquartered in downtowns in particular. Yeah. Felt I was swimming against the tide, or whatever. No matter what I worked on, it was hard to believe it could ever happen, whether it was new downtown housing or actually did a lot of work early on around transportation planning for development around a new MBTA station, et cetera. It was all much more aspirational than real. I remember reading an article in The Economist that said that while Houston looked like the future, and this was probably getting close just around 1980, that actually, of all places, Boston was much more the future because Houston was auto-dependent, very spread out, didn't lend itself to the kinds of density and interactions that produced ideas in an economy that was shifting from creating value through products to an economy increasingly creating value through ideas. And I thought, well, this is very encouraging because, you know, we happen to live here now. But I then watched it come true and came to realize that what gave me a much more interesting career, I chaired the Boston Society of Architects Urban Design Committee for a number of years, and also the National AIA Urban Design Committee. But what really gave me a profession I could not only love but find rewarding and, how should I say it, valid, was Boston's rapid recovery from decades of depression. When the Prudential Building was built in the late 1960s, early 1970s in Boston, I don't know if you know of it, it was the first new major downtown building, even though it's not quite downtown, since the Depression in Boston. I mean, it was really that depressed. I suddenly saw that a new economy brought with it the potential to create the kinds of places and the kind of communities I believed in, if that makes sense. I then got very interested in the role that density plays in shaping our environments. Density was, it's still a third rail term to a lot of folks, but boy, in the 1980s and 90s, it really was. Became very interested in what sort of density did it take to create a block of walkable Main Street? What sort of density did it take to support access to transit? What sort of density did it take to create all the things that people wanted in urban environments? They were fighting the very tool that could deliver them, meaning the density of people and buying power, et cetera, that could bring a street, a walkable main street to life and make transit make sense. And so over the 1990s, 80s, 90s, and up to about early 2000, that became more and more my focus. And actually, I helped organize, actually, I did, or I was spearheaded with the National AIA and the Boston Society of Architects in 2003, the first national conference on density, myth and reality.
Oh, wow.
And the whole point was to get people interested in the value density could create so we could actually have discussions about what the right densities were, because without those discussions, we couldn't create the communities we wanted.
Oh, yeah.
We couldn't support the transit we aspired to be relevant to this conversation. Yeah. Boston Globe, somebody in the Boston Globe wrote an editorial called me Density's Darling, which was a mixed blessing as a title in those days. Yeah. But since then, I've become increasingly interested in having seen how the recovery of Boston's economy unlocked the ability for me to be the kind of urban designer and planner that I wanted to be, and to give communities a chance to have the things they said they wanted, became increasingly interested in what I began to realize was the reality of what I did, which was helping people manage change and draw from this change the benefits they sought. One of the concerns that I and others had as we became more and more sort of advocates of urban living and downtowns was, you know, now were we going to lapse from reality? And I talked to some folks at the Urban Land Institute about this, went down to Washington, D.C. to talk to them. And they said, look, our demographics are changing in ways that are going to create much more support for urban places. Fewer and fewer households with kids, et cetera, which is what drove a lot of the flight to the suburbs. So putting that and a shift from an industrial economy to a dominance by an industrial economy to dominance by a knowledge economy, which had much more reason to be downtown, and shifting demographics that meant that much more of our household growth, which is the housing market, would be folks without kids who are much more likely to prefer urban living. I became increasingly excited about how can communities come to understand this message and then put in place the tools to manage these changes to create the kinds of communities they wanted. I'm sort of repeating myself. So, for example, how many years ago was this? About 20 years ago. Yeah. Was asked to prepare a plan to shape the next era of growth for Kendall Square, which is the heart of our New England's life science economy and one of the major life science centers, clusters in the U.S. And at that point, there was lots of research space in Kendall Square, but the streets were dull. And the companies that were there were already competing for the talent they needed, the educated folks who were already beginning to be in short supply. And we're afraid these folks were all going to want to go to Seattle and the companies were going to have to follow. And so I then talked to a real estate economist I know named Pam McKinney to find out, well, how many housing units would it take to bring blocks of Main Street to life? Because that's what these companies wanted. They didn't worry about the ability to create more research space. What they really worried about was a place where their workforce wanted to be and would talk to each other. So she said, well, 1,000 to 2,000 units. And I would say that figure now is around 1,000 units of housing. Wow. Within a five-minute block can bring a block of Main Street to life. That means attract the core retailers who will then make it a destination.
Yeah.
Armed with that information, I was then able to make the case to the neighborhoods around Central Square around Kendall Square who were, actively, but ardently fighting any increased density in Kendall Square because they saw it as more traffic on their local streets, got them to see the benefits to them. Because if Kendall Square could be a center of housing density with maybe 10 or 20,000 people living there, those folks would support all kinds of restaurants and cafes and music and amenities that the surrounding folks in Cambridge's neighborhoods would value. And we could simply use zoning to keep that density from spilling directly into their neighborhoods. And they understood that. And actually, we extended the density to Central Square, and somebody started it was a YIMBY as opposed to a NIMBY organization. Yes, in my backyard, because he felt that he really wanted Cambridge residents to understand that if they managed the forces of change and used density as the primary tool to do that, they could achieve many of the things they wanted without undermining the quality of life in their neighborhoods that they valued so much. Is this broadly making sense?
Yeah, this makes a lot of sense. So I a while ago, I ran track at Georgia Tech too, and I used to go to the Boston University over there, and we would hang out around the Harvard area. They usually use the Harvard track as the warm-up track, and being there, you see how dense like a lot of the stores and stuff is, like, and they have the old cobblestone and they have the old, you know, architecture as well. Was that always like that? And like, I wonder, like, I know a little, you know, some of the dorms are a little bit more spread out over there, but the main strip is like very, very dense. Like, it reminds me of like, I don't know, parts of New York. I'm from New York. I'm actually in New York right now. I went to Fordham for my undergrad, and Fordham was a little bit more spread out, but something like NYU, it was like, you know, you're going to class here, you eat there, you sleep here. So like everything is like right all around you. I feel like you had a very similar, I don't know,
Let's say Harvard Square historically has been a very cool place. I went to, the GSD graduate school design for my urban design degree, and just loved Cambridge in those days. The rest of, you know, Central Square, Kendall Square were much duller places, and didn't have the kinds of densities around them that supported a lot of life on the street. Today they do. And frankly, it was the plan for Kendall Square and Central Square and the community support for that plan when they understood how it could benefit them that unlocked that density and therefore vitality, if that makes sense, and life on the street. Harvard Square has always had it because there was Harvard right next door. Lots of students lived nearby, and it was a destination in its own right.
Yeah. Okay. That's awesome. I guess moving on. So I was looking at some of the, I guess specifically with transit-oriented design. I know you've done a little bit of, you know, work around that. Specifically, the revitalization of the East Franklin in Columbus. I was looking at
East Franklinton. Yes.
Yeah. And then the one Charleston in Boston. I know we were just talking about Boston. That was the unit of mixed income and.
I can tie both of those together. What I was just saying, not being repetitive, but so one of the thing, East Franklinton was probably the poorest part of Columbus, Ohio. It is right across the street from downtown. Columbus is now a booming place because it has the second most students per capita after Boston in the U.S. And they didn't used to stay in Columbus. Increasingly, they are. And it's building an idea economy. Anyway, but long story short, East Franklinton remained very depressed. It had been an area where a lot of migrants from Appalachia had settled. They were poor when they arrived, and they stayed poor. And the decline of, obviously, the industrial economy in Ohio contributed to that. In fact, it sort of reversed any progress they were making. So city really wanted to revive East Franklinton, which was really probably the most oppressed part of the Franklinton neighborhood that already was poor. There was sort of an arts colony there because a fellow had bought two empty factories and turned them into artist studios. So artists started to live in the very cheap housing nearby. I knew already that there was a tremendous unmet market for urban housing, but in walkable, mixed-use, amenitized places. So to simply say, gee, let's add a whole bunch of new housing to East Franklinton, wasn't going to work. And I'm going to come to gentrification displacement in a minute, because it's an immediate question people should have. But if we could arrange with the city to provide a critical mass of long-term affordable housing for artists, then it would turn into an enduring arts community that wouldn't gentrify itself out of existence, so to speak. There was a lot of also vacancy, abandoned property at this point in East Franklinton. So the idea that it wasn't about gentrification so much as refilling. These artists would come, they would stay, they would create a really unique community, which in turn would attract a lot of other folks who wanted to be around cool folks and the kind of cafes and microbreweries that they supported. And that's exactly what happened. So East Franklinton has actually emerged. The plan was put in place. There was a local community development corporation that developed something called the Idea Factory that could be sort of the heart of this community for artists and increasingly entrepreneurs and folks who wanted to start new tech companies and innovation companies, et cetera, could sort of be the heart of their community. East Franklinton has subsequently drawn more investment, sort of innovation economy and investment, tech investment, than any other part of Columbus, because it is a cool place that attracted the talent that then attracts the jobs and investment. And it has really helped put Columbus on the sort of global, is maybe a little bit of hyperbole, but on certainly on the national map of places where if you're young and bright and inventive and the kind of person that an innovation company is going to want to have access to, you know, Columbus is on your map. And therefore, it became on the map for the companies that would invest and create the jobs. Is that making sense? Okay.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Okay. Fast forward to One Charlestown. One Charlestown represents the redevelopment of the largest public housing development in New England. Bunker Hill Public Housing is, I hope all your listeners know, the Battle of Bunker Hill was fought in Charlestown on Banks Hill. Interestingly enough, the shot that won the battle for the Americans was fired by an African-American who shot I don't know if he killed him or just wounded him, the commander of the British forces. And there's a very well-known painting of that shooting. But so here was a 1,100 units of public housing, largely Black, to some extent Latino, sitting now right across the street, across Bunker Hill Avenue, from a highly gentrified historic Charlestown, where you might spend $2 million or more to buy a condominium, let alone a house. That made One Charlestown or Bunker Hill Housing an excellent candidate for mixed income housing. I had done a lot of redevelopment. I got very involved in the redevelopment of Cabrini in Chicago a number of years before then, and was very aware that there was a very strong market, very underserved market for urban folks who can afford to move into cities, undersupplied in Boston like everywhere else. That a lot of these folks were not at all averse to living in mixed income housing the way they might have been their parents 20, 25 years earlier. and that we could increase the density of this public housing to the level where it could accommodate everybody who lived in public housing and wanted to come back. So there would be zero displacement and have the critical mass, let's say 60% of the total housing that would make this work for the market side of the equation also, in effect, creating a mixed income neighborhood. That there were a lot of nearby Charlestown residents who wanted Bunker Hill to go away, but they came to understand the benefits of mixed income housing. And the Bunker Hill residents who, you know, this was their home and the world they knew, came to understand the benefits of living in a mixed income community. And one story I remember telling, I had done a lot of planning in Alexandria, Virginia, to redevelop public housing there into mixed income housing. And there was a lot of skepticism within the community, within the neighbors and among neighbors who largely affluent and the public housing residents themselves. And we went on a tour of mixed income housing in Washington, D.C. All got in a bus together. And there was this one anecdote, I don't know, the story that a public housing resident told, a woman told, about when her husband had been in the downstairs in washing his car in the parking that was underneath the house that he lived in. And he was washing his car right next to a market rate resident who was washing his car. And they started a conversation. Her husband mentioned he was unemployed. The fellow who was talking to said, "Oh, my company's hiring. Why don't you come by?" He did and got a job. And she said, "Do you think when we lived in public housing, anybody even imagined the phrase, my company's hiring?" There was no concept of something like that.
Oh, no.
And it was talking to the market rate residents who were largely white. They really appreciated, they said, not living in a white bubble. They felt they and their families, their kids were living in the real world and getting the benefits of that. It was entirely successful. So to bring that lesson to the good folks of Charlestown and the name One Charlestown, I sort of adopted for planning purposes because we had poor and rich Charlestown next to each other. We're now going to take two Charlestowns and make Charlestowns and make them one Charlestown. And that name has actually stuck. So that's the development currently in the neighborhood currently in development.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. And then I guess moving towards just some of the more high impact projects that you did, I wanted to look at the covering highways stuff. I know you had done something with the you had done like a planetization course that was on like covering of highways and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I know in Atlanta we have the Stitch that's, you know, being put together soon, hopefully. But they, you know, that's been a really big thing. And, you know, coming from New York, Robert Moses, a lot of the highways that, you know, split a lot of communities up there and, you know, driving over them every day to get, you know, to school at Fordham or into the city. I've heard about it a lot and seen it, you know, real time. So I wanted to hear a little bit about that and how you became, like, why did that become important to you? And I don't know, connecting it to today, like, how can we, you know, move some of more of these projects forward in different parts of the country as well?
Okay, so I'm going to come back to familiar themes, actually. So first of all, I did a plan for the city of Boston around the year 2000, 25 years ago, my gosh, on it's a plan for air rights development over the Mass Turnpike, which was an open cut that basically extended from the western suburbs into the heart of Boston and was all about bringing suburbanites downtown for a while, for many years. And the chief opposition to the plan, and this is not surprising these days, came from the folks who live in the South End, the neighborhood I live in today, historic South End, who said in some cases we'll be gentrified out, but in most cases the density it'll take to develop air rights, support the cost of air rights, will dominate our neighborhoods, change our character, and we'll lose the historic intimacy that we love and enjoy and have fought to preserve and protect. And on the other hand, a lot of folks are saying there's no way, given the cost of air rights development, that it will ever be feasible. And so, how should I say it? Once again, I knew there was tremendous untapped demand for housing. I also was able to work, I and a team of folks, work with the now my good neighbors, but the good neighbors of neighborhood folks of the South End, to understand the protections the city could put in place so that development, air rights development, which could easily be 20 to 30 floors, if not more, would only be air rights developed. It would not move across the street into their neighborhood. First of all, it couldn't because it required large chunks of land, and it would take a lifetime to buy up enough individual properties in the South End to do that. But that's a minor detail. It just, public policy clearly had a stake in the public good in making it very sharp, sharply differentiating between the two. And that, once again, all this density on the turnpike could bring the beleaguered retail in the South End to life. More people would make this a more walkable, lively, fun place to neighborhood to live in. But also that it was increasingly important for Boston to repair the damage of urban renewal, the highways, the turnpike that cut through it, separated historic neighborhoods of Back Bay and the South End, the central artery, which was an elevated highway that cut through the midst of downtown and separated the waterfront and North End from the financial district, et cetera, that all of this needed to change because going forward, if Boston were going to succeed, it's going to succeed as a city that really appeals to people. You want to live here. That's why the talent to power our what I now call idea economy can continue to grow because we can attract folks. Well, attracting folks these days has nothing to do with highways. It has to do with creating a place they want to live that is livable, that meets their lifestyle preferences, et cetera. And that was all about historic neighborhoods, walkable neighborhood, mixed-use places, highly amenitized places, places where you could go get a beer in 5 minutes and be walk another direction, be at work in 5 minutes, and all those great things. And that highways had nothing to do and, in fact, were utterly inimical to the kinds of qualities that Boston needed today to be the city it could be and needed to be. Is this making sense?
Yeah.
And I went on to be much more not in the direct consulting role but in an advocacy role when I was president of the Boston Society of Architects and worked with other colleagues who were more active than I was. To advocate not only for taking down the central artery, this is sort of the reverse of air rights, removing the highway so the ground, the sun could shine to touch the ground below it, into a real source of amenity for downtown that would make it much more a place that people wanted to live and play and eat dinner and have fun and enjoy the waterfront, not just come to their office building. Is this enough of an answer? Is that making sense?
Yeah, no, that makes really good. And I guess just for like the public and voters, like, is there, I feel like sometimes there is pushback when you're like, obviously it has such a good intent and like, people want to see this, especially the people in the communities. Is there anything that, needs to be phrased or, maybe the perspective needs to be changed when you are explaining these things to the public and to voters?
And particularly, let's say, we don't do a good job of accounting for costs versus benefits in our country today. When we look at air rights, we look immediately at the terrific expense of building a deck or in other ways creating development, public space, a place people can actually use, enjoy, that contributes to the quality of their life over a highway. We look at that cost, but we don't look at the increase in real estate values that will almost always more than compensate for the cost of that air rights deck. We don't look at the benefits in terms of making our community more attractive to the kinds of folks who then draw investment and good jobs to this region. We don't look enough at the just the ability to enhance the quality and character of our urban core, or El Paso's urban core, or the urban core of so many cities where these are issues today, and the value to the city of doing that. And when you do, it, I would say it's very hard to make the argument that not investing in the cap or the air rights has been a good idea.
That's great.
And it, you know what? It gets back to an interdisciplinary perspective.
Yeah. That's so true. Yeah.
I'll make one other gratuitous comment here. I have a friend and colleague who organized, Larry Frank, who teaches at the University of California at San Diego and has formed a firm called Urban Design for Health and does a lot of research, or had done, for the CDC, et cetera. And the point he often makes is you can't invest enough in transit to exceed the benefits in terms of reduced public health costs by not building that transit, meaning that people who live in auto-dependent environments and therefore walk much less, have lifespans that are on average 10 years less than those who live in walkable mixed use places that encourage walking. Public health, whether it's diabetes or heart disease or whatever, the incidences are much lower in, you know, holding steady for income and other determinants of health for walkable mixed use urban places. When it comes to transit, which I think at one point was going to be the topic of this call, investing in transit and getting people out of their cars and walking to the station and walking when they leave invariably justifies the expense, but we have no way of doing that accounting.
Yeah.
And we pay a very big price by not being able to do that accounting.
Yeah. That's awesome. I guess, moving to transit. So one of the next things I had was some of the BRT projects that you did. I feel like these are really overlooked today. Like a lot of people are looking for this big rail or high speed rail, you know, which is great. And I would love to see it too. But BRT is like very easy to implement, and a lot of places don't have this. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it is also the perspective where people, you know, they think of a bus and they're like, oh, I would never take a bus. That's for, you know, I can afford a car. I don't need to take the bus. And, you know, even though it's going to take them there in a third of the time, you know, it's way faster, it's way more efficient, you know, and a lot of the buses, especially the newer BRTs today are very nice. Like I was in Europe this past summer, and a lot of the ones in France that we were in Paris, like right outside the main circle, and I couldn't believe, like, in 10 minutes I could be right in the middle, you know, at the museums and everything. Yeah. And it was just so easy the way it was already, like, it was done. And a lot of it was just buses and chronographs and all of these things that just made it so much more easily. And I know you did the blue line, which was like a battery electric one in Indianapolis, which I hope, you know, becomes, hope there's a lot more electric ones in the future.
Let me say, I don't think I did do that, but thank you for the credit.
Okay.
However, I can speak to your point. So when people say, gee, it's more convenient to use my car or whatever, what they don't realize is how much it is costing them. It costs, on average, $15,000 or more to own and operate each car a household needs. If you live in a fully auto-dependent area and there are two adults, you probably need two cars. You might even need more.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. You can't possibly spend half that much using BRTs and then Ubers and cabs when a BRT isn't going to take you where you want, but you can't go car free or car light unless you have confidence that you have the basic connections you need, whether it's to education or to a job or to healthcare, et cetera. And that's where a bus, BRT, or light rail, or even, or heavy rail, but a BRT, it's much easier to expand that access with buses. At the same time, that doesn't even address the cost of parking, et cetera, when you get there, which in a major city can be quite expensive. But you can also do other things on the bus. You can read a book. You can listen to your podcast.
Yeah.
you can do all kinds of things that you can't do in a car. And plus, you walk to the bus and you walk from the bus to your location. So there are all kinds of reasons. As we approach the era of autonomy, as the advent of mobility innovations becomes nearer and nearer, you know, first connected, then autonomous mobility, we are going to be much more able, for example, to use driverless buses, driverless shuttles, et cetera, that can also provide much finer grain and still less expensive service. So the real, I'm going to say, what's the golden age of, I'd say, bus seems like an inadequate term, but bus transportation, I think, is before us, not behind us. When buses and we can use our phones to know exactly when that vehicle's going to arrive. My son, older son, lives in Amsterdam. I was just fascinated. We could travel all over the Netherlands without even thinking about a car. The minute we were going to leave his apartment with his four-year-old son, who didn't have all that much patience, so we needed to know when the bus was going to arrive. Three-year-old son, what am I saying? He knew when that bus would arrive within a minute or two, and they were accurate. Could then connect to the tram, to commuter rail, to the train, whatever we were going to use. We can certainly duplicate that level of service, and my son doesn't have to spend. He probably say it's probably like a $5,000 to $10,000 a year subsidy for his family to be able to do that.
Yeah,
simply by not owning one car.
Yeah, wow, that's awesome. Yeah, I feel
like
there's
a lot more fun.
Yeah, I feel like there's so many you spoke about so many of the positive things that comes out of that. And I guess one of the biggest things, going back to just public policy and making this, evident to a lot of the voters and a lot of the public, how do we sort of change the narrative where it's not for underprivileged, lower socioeconomic, areas and groups, but really showing, somewhere like New York, where no matter what income level you're everyone's taking the subway to get to work, no matter where you are. And if you're not, you're walking.
So first of all, actually, I'm going to answer a different question that you just reminded me of for a minute, because I mentioned before and forgot. If it costs $15,000 a year on average to own and operate a car, imagine if you live anywhere near the poverty line, even at which is these days going to be $40,000 to $50,000 a year for a family of even three. Suppose and you could afford one car. Somebody else is sick. Somebody else wants to go to school. Somebody else wants a job. You're completely stuck, and it is an immense burden to have to own that one car at that cost. So we're talking about folks who have choices. There are a lot of folks who don't have a choice, who desperately need enhanced transit to just be able to lead healthy lives with access to opportunity and education. Okay, so now let's jump ahead. I did planning for, I've done planning for, in a couple of cases, I find these projects just fascinating. In effect, a new suburban downtown, mixed use, walkable, heart to suburb. And actually, if you think about it, going forward, the next 20 years, somewhere between 70% to 80% of net new households are going to be singles and couples. We have unprecedented demand for urban housing, mixed use, walkable, amenitized places. that's just as true in the suburbs as it is in cities. People may think first of cities, but believe me, when the way suburbs are going to grow is in urban ways, the redevelopment of failed malls, strip centers, et cetera, into probably primarily multifamily housing and mixed-use walkable places, et cetera. But fast forward. One of the early projects I did was for a city called Sandy Springs, a suburb called Sandy Springs. Oh, you're in Atlanta, outside
of Atlanta. Yeah, okay. I was like, I know that one.
Okay. Well, Sandy Springs was very proud of its suburban nature, heritage, culture, et cetera. But they're very astute, very politically conservative and astute mayor who had actually led the effort to incorporate Sandy Springs said, we need a heart. We need a downtown. We need a place where we can put a city hall. And she said, and a performance center so that we'll draw the full spectrum of who we are together. All right. So we were hired to do a plan to convert a group of sort of failing or declining strip centers into this downtown. They adopted the plan. To my amazement, they then, this is after we finished working the project, chose to call it City Springs. The idea that Sandy Springs would call a place City Springs, I still enjoy, I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
But more than that, Sandy Springs had consistently opposed, there's a term that in the Atlanta region, communities are asked to dedicate a portion of higher sales tax toward transportation. You can find the term and introduce it, but Sandy Springs had repeatedly, and this is basically by sort of a regional vote referendum, had leadership, the community leadership had opposed doing this because, frankly, the attitude in Sandy Springs was that the kinds of people who rode transit used MARTA weren't them. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah.
As they completed City Springs or made progress with City Springs, they began to attract a broader range of folks who wanted to live in Sandy Springs, younger folks with kids in many cases, but folks who wanted, had much more urban sensibilities. Eventually, they actually came to realize that it was in their, how should I say, enlightened self-interest to attract these folks because they were attracting jobs and investment and all kinds of cool stuff to Sandy Springs. And these folks made it very clear that they wanted at least a connector to MARTA. If MARTA couldn't come to City Springs, they wanted some form of shuttle or other transit connector. And to get that, Sandy Springs turned around and endorsed a sales tax override, I guess it is, or whatever, additional public funding to expand MARTA and improve MARTA service. Actually, with pretty much, I'd say, town-wide support and enthusiasm.
Yeah. So I think it's the title ad valorem tax. Is that it?
Or yes,
is it-
but there's a term for... I'll look it up and
for
doing this. But it's there's a referendum that periodically is put on the ballot across greater Atlanta communities about whether or not to impose this ad valorem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then I guess moving on towards smart mobility and transit-driven development. There is some micromobility. Have you worked with micromobility?
Not as much, and you're probably going to find transportation planners who can speak much more to it, but first mile, last mile connectivity to transit really matters, and that is to a large extent about micromobility.
Could you speak a little bit about that and I don't know, any projects or how you see it, you know, being used in the future? I know a lot of people, you know, we have Lime, we have all these things, and looking at the first mile, last mile, you know, there's a lot of research around this. I remember at Georgia Tech, a lot of people did a lot of research around this, but I guess connecting the first, last mile with some of the mixed use development and how that might look in like some of these mixed use areas, I guess also like these downtowns that we are creating, we do see this a lot, especially in Atlanta, where they're trying to connect a lot of these things and they're throwing the scooters everywhere just to get, you know, get people around. I do enjoy it. It's fun. I know on campus almost, you know, everybody rides the scooters around campus. So I'm not sure if you have any idea of like how this plays a role in downtown specifically.
Okay, so first of all, I did a downtown plan for Memphis for spent approximately 4 seconds on a scooter. It scared me to death and I got off and haven't gotten one since. However, what to me, from one perspective, they're real evidence of the value, once again, of density, because these mobility innovations, fine-grained innovations, micro-mobility, only work at scale where they can really make a difference, where you have enough density to support them. And therefore, they can be introduced. People can start using them. And then in some ways, it's a what's the term? A virtuous cycle.
Can be repeated.
Because when you have communities that have on-demand bikes and on-demand scooters and other things, those become more convenient places to live. And the value, the cost of living there can go up. That's one challenge. So you create fiscal value, let's put it that way. You also, density delivers its own benefits by supporting not only micro-mobility, but cool cafes and outdoor dining and all kinds of experiments makes itself more desirable as a place to live and work. And I'd say micromobility is one reflection of that.
Yeah,
it's also clearly important to look at mobility as a system, particularly transit, because first mile, last mile is a term often used, but it really is important. It's great to have transit, but if you have to walk 20 minutes to get there and 20 minutes back, it isn't particularly okay. Most of us will walk about 5 minutes without a really good reason. Microtransit really sort of expands the sort of the walk shed in that or the transit shed in that regard.
Yeah. So actually I had one other thing before I get to the last section. There was, I guess, TOD districts. I looked at this a lot.
Can I add one more point?
Yes, please do.
So it also just so happens if you look, most people in this country move by the time they're 35, but make their major move in terms of where they're going to have their economic lives, where they're going to have jobs, therefore where they're going to contribute to a local economy. The folks that, in the crassest sense, communities, cities, regions really need to attract are educated folks under the age of 35 with some higher education. Nothing correlates more directly with being under the age of 35 and having some higher education than not wanting an auto-dependent life.
Yeah.
So if you're a community that can offer micro-mobility access to transit, scooters and on-demand bikes, et cetera, on-demand micro-mobility, that's economic development. That's attracting the folks who then help you build your economy. And before this sounds unbearably elitist, City of Buffalo, which paid a whole lot of attention to this because it needs to make the case that we need to build a knowledge economy to folks who don't necessarily feel they're going to be part of that economy, has did a lot of research and determined that each new idea economy job that Buffalo attracted generated five other jobs across the skills and education spectrum, often in industries for people in industries that were shedding jobs. And it turns out that growing your idea economy is literally the path to sustained economic growth. And without sustained economic growth, you can't create opportunities for those who are left out of this economy today, who have greater challenge. You can't break the cycle of intergenerational poverty, et cetera. So it's no region can really afford not to try and do the things we're talking about. And micromobility is right in there, because if you can you know, live 20 minutes from transit and still have access to it, not need a car, that's one of the things that will make you want to go live in that city, in that neighborhood.
Okay. Okay. Let's. I'm going to let you try putting your video on. I'm going to turn mine off for a second. Okay. Yeah, I think we're good again. And yeah, just going off of that too, I know that like the transit oriented districts, I know that was really good. I was in Denver for a conference, and that was a really good city that, you know, really, really harnessed that. I don't know if you've done any work with TOD districts or whatnot, but I wanted to hear your take on
it. Yes, and I'm going to actually give credit to a guy named John Zena, who's the plan director in Memphis. I mentioned a downtown plan for Memphis and got to know John. And he really, for the downtown plan for Memphis, we said basically in downtown, you want to encourage as much housing as possible, but with financial incentives, et cetera. But you need to use these incentives as a tool to encourage this housing, to focus this housing within 5 minutes of the existing walkable main streets, retail streets, or emerging sort of retail hubs that you want to encourage. If you spread this housing out, so it's a 10-minute walk, you won't bring a street to life. If the housing is within 5 minutes, you will bring a street to life, if that makes sense. So fast forward. John really championed the benefits of compact critical mass across Memphis. He identified neighborhood centers across Memphis that had the chance to grow in a compact way, to become livelier, to become therefore more attractive as places to live and work. And on the one hand, shifted planning for transit, in many cases bus rapid transit, BRT, to these areas so that they could use transit as a as an incentive to attract investment, particularly housing, but then basically use zoning and other tools to ensure that all of this new investment and development occurred within a 5-minute walk of the transit station, of the service being provided. Because without this compact critical mass, the benefits of this investment in terms of a livelier, more walkable, community-rich city or neighborhood didn't happen. Is that fair? Is that making sense?
Yeah,
that's good. And I really appreciated this. He extended what is a rule that's very important to apply downtown across Memphis.
Okay. Thank you. And then the last, so that concludes like the majority of the questions and whatnot.
Okay.
But I have a high, I'm calling it the high speed question section. And we're going to go through, there's like 10 questions. And these are more short form answers, the best you can, you know, doesn't have to be one word or anything like that. But these are more rapid fire, short form questions.
Okay, I'll try.
Yeah. Okay. So starting with the first one, if you could magically redesign one transportation system overnight, what city would you choose and why?
I would actually go back to a plan we did for to introduce streetcar service in Washington, D.C. And what I realized was that by providing this finer grain transit access, we gave virtually every parent in Washington, D.C. a chance to walk their kid to school, then jump on a trolley to get to work. We could provide affordable housing across the city that did not require owning a car and therefore really did serve the needs of those who needed that affordable housing. We also increased the value of a considerable portion of housing of neighborhoods in Washington, in the district, by enough to pay for a substantial portion of the cost of introducing bus rapid trolley service, rather. and to fund affordable housing to compensate for this increased value.
That's awesome. The next one.
Fine grain transit.
The next one, electric vehicles or public transit, which will have the bigger impact on urban mobility in the next decade?
Transit.
Public transit.
Electric vehicles are still privately owned vehicles.
That's good. Number three, what's the single most underrated transportation innovation that could transform cities? So this doesn't have to be a specific, you know.
At this point, I would say it is nervousness, resistance to planning for an era of autonomy, because people assume that everyone is going to want their own autonomous vehicle. In fact, the economics and convenience factors that go into making these decisions will make shared autonomous mobility much more attractive. And this is very supportive of the compact critical mass of riders and destinations that you find in urban neighborhoods and in downtowns in the heart of our cities. So in fact, shared autonomous mobility will actually, among other things, take the form of a subsidy. These households will save $5,000 to $10,000 a year on what they're spending on transportation today by living in a mixed-use, walkable downtown or urban neighborhood.
That's great.
And many of the people who would naturally advocate for this are opposed because they hear the word vehicle and don't look to the benefits of shared and autonomy.
Like that. Number four, is a car-free downtown district an inevitable future or unrealistic dream?
It's a worthy dream that if one attempts to realize it literally is unrealistic. And I think as long as – no, it is unrealistic. I mean, people do need to be able to arrive at their front door. we can give them many more options for doing that.
Yeah.
But I doubt we'll have car-free downtowns.
Okay.
Nor do we need to.
No, yeah. We just need options, I feel like.
Yeah.
What's one bold transportation prediction that might sound crazy today, but you believe will come true in the next decade as well?
Next decade. The U.S. automobile fleet turns over every 15 years. I don't know how bold this is. So yeah. 10 years from now, the norm will increasingly be connected vehicles, which can park 6 inches from each other, drive 6 inches from each other. They simply don't bump into each other.
Yeah.
And in all sorts of other ways, their movements can be coordinated, freeing up in every downtown and urban neighborhood in America space for wider sidewalks, more street trees, more parklets and outdoor dining, and all for better for freeing up streets for community building uses.
I like that. Which instrumental city has the transportation system America should be most jealous of?
Amsterdam.
And why do you say that?
Because Amsterdam, literally, modes are integrated, connected. You literally, it is a burden to have a car in the city of Amsterdam. And not only does that make life a lot more pleasurable, it makes housing a lot less expensive because you don't have to invest in expensive parking. It frees up land that otherwise would be needed for less expensive parking, e.g. surface parking lots, for parks and green space, literally. It enhances quality of life, and it saves folks who live in Amsterdam a lot of money. Like and that. Encourages a lot of – promotes community.
Yeah. Like that. Is the 15 – I know we talked a little bit about this with density. Is the 15-minute city concept achievable in most American suburbs, or have we lost our mind?
We've lost our mind. I would say it's going to have to be for suburbs to stay competitive going forward, given the dynamics of the housing market. In cities, what matters more are actually not 15-minute cities, but 5-minute neighborhoods where you can live, work, play, learn, innovate, run into friends, share community. all within a 5-minute walk of each activity of 5-minute walk of the other. Because most people walk 5 minutes, and if you want to give them a truly multi-dimension life, the one they want, all those things need to be available within a 5-minute walk of each other.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe it's the 5-minute city. And then the next one is autonomous vehicles, yes or no, and why? I know you spoke a little bit about this.
I would say absolutely yes. First of all, because it's like gravity. We don't have a choice. They're going to be less expensive, more convenient. And now let's get back to cities are in the business of attracting folks to want to live in downtowns, in urban neighborhoods. Suburbs are going to be increasingly competing for their share of the pie. Autonomous mobility is going to provide the convenience and lower cost that's going to be part of that competition.
That's good. And then, so this is a little wider, but if you were the Secretary of Transportation for a day and had unlimited budget, what's the first project you'd greenlight?
What's the first project I would greenlight? Probably any transit extension I knew of. I also am a strong believer in intercity high-speed rail because the ability to connect particularly downtowns. If you can walk to high-speed rail and ultimately go from Tampa to Miami in a couple of hours, that brings the idea economies in both cities together as one larger idea economy, because people can interact, meet, talk, run into each other, not in ways that are confined by where they live, but literally the mobility they have access to.
That's really good. And then the last one, this one has nothing to do with transportation or anything else, but if you had someone over at your house, what dish would you cook them if you wanted to make something for them?
Okay. My favorite dish in the world is shrimp Creole, but I've got to tell you, I don't cook. Okay. So I would pick something up on the way home.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's it.
I would like to thank you again for listening. This was an amazing conversation, and I feel like I learned a lot, and I think you guys will too. Again, please like, comment, and subscribe. I would want to hear your feedback. I want to hear what you liked, what you didn't like. I want to hear everything so I can keep making this better and keep bringing the great people for you guys. I'm going to be starting my job literally next week, so I want to get going as far as I can and stay consistent, because I think there's so many people that I've met, and I want to share those ideas and thoughts that I've learned over the years with you. So please let me know what you guys are looking for and whatnot. And thank you for watching.